Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you are listening to STEM Spots. And with me in the studio today is Peter Salomon, who's a professor of mathematics at San Diego State University. He's also a participant in the Telluride Science Research Center series of conferences this summer, and he's at a conference on thermodynamics, I think nanoscale thermodynamics. Thanks for stopping by, Peter.
Well, thank you for having me, David.
So, Peter, talk a little bit about your general interest in thermodynamics. How far back does that go exactly? How does your training fit into that?
Oh, I'm afraid that reveals my age. But it goes back to the early 70s and the oil embargo that we had. And that was when I was a beginning graduate student, very interested in thermodynamics at the time. And it made us look originally for what were the limitations to being able to extract energy from any physical chemical process in finite time. So as opposed to the traditional classical thermodynamics, which doesn't have time built in, that's what we tried to do. And it's been 50 years in the making, or close.
So that would be confusing for the general listener, conceivably. They kind of know what thermodynamics is, but maybe not exactly. So in a couple of sentences, what do you think thermodynamics means if just the average person is thinking about it? Is it just energetics? Talk about what it means.
Well, it is a many-splendored thing. In fact, that's one of the wonderful things about the subject is that the engineers and biologists and chemists and physicists all think it's very different set of facts that are tied together. But really, it's a set of principles that limit the in-principle ability to extract useful work out of a process or a system. Conservation of energy is the first law. The other two are a little harder to appreciate and understand, but it's limitations on what's possible in the way of energy conversion.
So you got started out in kind of an odd way with an oil embargo, and then it's developed over that amount of time. So talk about what you're working on now, or let's say over the last few years.
Well, the last many years, actually, so I don't know, close to 20 at this point, I've tried to pay attention to biological processes and looking at the energy conversion and energy extraction that biological systems do. It's just the stage of understanding biology where we're starting to get some successes quantitatively. And the level of understanding, if you can predict quantitatively versus just the qualitative prediction, is the difference between night and day. Being able to use Aristotelian gravity where everything seeks its own level has some explanatory value, but it's not going to let you put a man on the moon.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it's a huge difference, and we get very good checks. And biology is just at the point where we're starting to get some quantitative predictions that actually match. Now, when we can do that with your blood pressure and how you respond to a drug or any kind of treatment, that will make a huge difference for medical science. When we can say how well a particular plant will do with a different set of genes, that will make a huge difference for our ability to feed people on Earth. It's an important area.
So talk about, for me, it's interesting because I know how sometimes we get compartmentalized. So physicists might have a difficult time just working amongst themselves, much less working with biologists. So talk a little bit about how you've developed some sort of collaborative interactions with the biologists so that you can each benefit.
It's actually the hardest part, I think, was finding a group that's open to quantitative techniques. A lot of people go into biology because they're interested in science but really don't want the mathematics part, which I'm afraid is probably nearing an end as far as a strategy that people can use as a way to get into science and still maintain some allergy to mathematics.
You found some people at SDSU, or did you find some people someplace else?
Oh, I found some people at SDSU. And in fact, I started working with a particular favorite collaborator before he was actually hired at SDSU. He had been a student there. He was there using the labs, but it was, at least at the time, not at all clear that he would actually end up with a job. The best thing about the collaboration is it stays at a deep level. So of course everything when you look at an experiment or try to explain an experiment, the details are at the forefront. But trying to pay attention to deeper concepts, that's where the real science and real future knowledge.
But when you think about the details, so if you two came to this collaboration, give me an example. Let's say you're doing something. What would the biology collaborator do versus what would you do as part of this collaboration?
That's a good question. Wow.
Would they go collect samples or would they do something else?
They go and collect samples off the coral reefs every summer. And the students go along. What they do with the samples is they sequence all of the DNA that's in there and from that try to make deductions about what's happening energetically or population biology-wise or evolution-wise or ecology. That's the source of modern biological information.
So they're providing detail. You said there's a lot of detail. They're giving you a lot of detail.
Well, they're giving me
and
or
everybody
a lot of detail. So, I can't say that I do the workup of that detail myself. Most of that, because DNA you can only read in fairly short chunks, although that's getting better. And then to put those together into what are the organisms that are there, what are the genes that they're carrying, what sort of reactions can those genes bring about, what are the energetics of those reactions. Now, the last step, I sort of start to get involved.
Okay. And so give an example. I think you told me a little bit about working on some algae stuff. So what is that exactly? Like algae and coral?
Algae and coral are fighting a battle for
supremacy?
Their survival. Yes, on all the coral reefs. The big problem there has typically been that they've been overfished. And the algae that would grow on the coral used to be eaten. Now, there used to be the food for the little fish that are hanging around. But those fish are not there anymore.
So do the little fish get fished out, or do the bigger fish that eat the little fish get fished out, or how did it all work?
Well, that actually I don't know that we have the details on. But the fact that the fish are missing is what lets the algae basically run wild and grow over the coral reefs. The energetics of that is actually sort of interesting and very, very different between the algae and the coral. Above, in the water column, above a coral reef, you have very scarce food. Whereas in the water column above the algae, there's tons of food. And the microbes that live in those water columns consequently do very different chemistry to extract energy for their livelihood from the plentiful food or the very scarce food. And this is where new thermodynamics comes in. One of the theorems that we ended up proving as a result of this is if you can take a thermodynamic process and break it into steps, so give it basically a place to stop, then you actually get better efficiency. You extract more of the usable work out of that.
Still limited by the classic Carnot efficiency or something like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Still limited by how much energy is there, but the faster you take it out, the less of it you actually get. That's where the finite time thermodynamics came in, and that's what we kept learning about engines. That's why we used to have the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit on all our freeways.
Right.
But this is an issue of if you put in more steps, you gain in efficiency. And that's what this group that I work with, this biology group that I work with, was able to demonstrate from all the metagenomic data. That is to say, taking all the DNA in the water columns, sequencing it, and figuring out what it comes from and what it's able to do. What they found is that above the coral, the actual burning of the foodstuff uses more steps, whereas above the algae, it's quick and it's dirty. I mean, they don't extract as much energy, but they're fast.
But they have plenty of energy, as you've already mentioned,
to
extract.
That's right. That's exactly the point.
And how does that play into diversity? So, I mean, a lot of people would think diversity in the genomic sequence is good. So are things more diverse above the algae? Is there more different things living there? Is that good? Is there, there's
well,
no moral quality
to this. It's a different ecosystem above the algae than above the coral. They have to work together. I don't know that you could call one better or worse, but they're very different. Or you certainly can't say that one is more diverse than the other.
Okay, good. I was curious about that. So now, that's a specific problem that people are interested in. Of course, they're interested in coral reefs, but mostly they're interested in preserving coral reefs. You hear about that all the time. They're worried about temperature of water and other kinds of things that might impact the future development of coral reefs, because the coral reef plays into an aesthetic for most people. They think coral reef, good. Coral reef, pretty, whatever it is. So do you get embroiled in that kind of stuff at all? Are the biologists interested in how do we keep the coral reefs from being superseded by algae, or are they fairly indifferent to that part of it?
Oh, no, they're very interested in that. That's what drives probably most of their research. And they have techniques. They've actually tried to use algicides and various ways of administering essentially medical practices to try to save the corals. But the temperature response is actually fairly attackable, I believe. So corals actually do some farming. They maintain bacteria that grow inside of them. And it's those bacteria that can't take the heat. So if we can re-engineer a similar bacterium or help them find good symbiotic.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. So what I'm interested in is when you go into something like this, you're thinking thermodynamics, you're thinking mathematics, you're thinking maybe modeling or paper and pencil thermal. How often do you think about how does this apply in the real world? Is that something that comes to mind a lot? Comes to mind only when you're giving public talks? Or how much does it impact what you do?
Actually, it impacts it a lot. I do applied mathematics. I call myself an applied mathematician. And it's largely because I like to see what I do result in something useful for the world. The other end of that is mathematicians traditionally work as singletons, alone. And I actually don't like working alone. I like talking to people. That's what's the wonderful thing about the Telluride workshops, is they're all discussions. I mean, people bring a talk, but they don't deliver a talk. They sort of use it as a foil to have a discussion with the audience.
Right. They're not talking at people. They're supposed to just stimulate things so that then something can happen.
Yes. Yes.
Have you found that that's been the same throughout your career? Do you think it's better than it was? Do you think that scientists are always good at collaborating? Or how does that all work? I'm curious about that.
Well, that's an interesting question. My belief on that, and maybe I should check it a little bit better, but traditionally, if you go back to the 19th century, collaboration was very rare in all areas of science, in any case, and mathematics. Now, why mathematics is taking longer to get out of that phase, I don't know, but that's actually, I started as a pure mathematics major back as a beginning student, and the thing that made me leave that was it's not done to this day. It's mostly done by people working alone.
Right.
Whereas applied math, and certainly if you bring it into science, you need a whole team of expertises, and to bring those different areas together, the discussions are fascinating and the progress is generally useful.
I would agree. So it's been very nice talking to you about this. So you would say that applied to mathematics, if brought to bear on problems that are of interest to the average person, can make an impact. Would you say that people are going into that? What does it look like? I know as a physicist, we struggle all the time with, not that many students going into physics, even though amazingly enough, the job market is pretty darn good. How do you guys see things in applied mathematics? Are you getting people into it? Do people want to go into it?
People definitely want to go into it. Our graduation rates are a little lower than we'd like, largely because like computer science students. And in fact, the ones that go into computer science find that they have wonderfully paying jobs before they get their degrees. And at that point, just let the degree sort of slide by the wayside.
Right. That can happen. Well, it's been a fascinating talking to you, Peter. I really appreciate you stopping by today.
Well, I have very much enjoyed your questions. I think you ask very good ones. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, this is Dave Cornelison for the extended version, the web version of STEM Spots, and also to once again mention the Telluride Science Research Center conferences and workshops in Telluride, Colorado. Thanks for stopping by.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.